Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 292 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be discussing some topics that are actually very high yield for the USMLE exams. And there are two cardiology topics, but again, they just show up all the time. I feel like people keep getting them wrong. So we'll see. So let's just jump right into it. I don't want to give up the topic because it'll pretty much give up what I'm discussing. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this is a 35-year-old guy and that he had a pacemaker that was placed in his heart like 2 weeks ago, but that over that, like the last 10 days, he's been having a lot of fevers, he's been having a lot of chills, he's been having shortness of breath. And that they tell you that, oh, when you listen to his heart, you can hear like a new murmur in the apex. If you see all these things, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking that this person potentially has endocarditis, right? Endocarditis. So I know you may be like, wow, Divine, pacemaker, come on, Divine, are you kidding? So the thing is, again, you may notice that some of the podcasts I've been making in recent times have been reflecting a mantra that our friends at the NBME, you know, kind of care about these days, right? They go after things that are common topics, but they just go after them in uncommon fashion. So that's one thing you need to almost like begin to adjust to so that you don't have any unpleasant surprises come testing, right? Because yes, don't get me wrong. Is the NBME testing some very new concepts? Absolutely, right? They're testing new concepts. November 2020, that was last year, they made all these changes. I've made tons of podcasts on that stuff. But they're also beginning to make a lot of changes just from, how do we test this same knowledge kind of deal, right? So I'll encourage you to kind of keep those things at the back of your mind as you study. So what are some things that are important with regards to endocarditis? Well, the first thing is you want to know some risk factors, right? Obviously, we know about the IV drug user. Right. But again, the IV drug user is not something, it's something that is pretty classic, but it's not something that may pop up on exams because they know that, again, probably every hanky deck known to man has that somewhere. Right. So who are some unusual patients that can have endocarditis on NBME exams? One, it can be people that have prosthetic heart valves, right? Especially with those people with staph epidermidis, because remember, staph epidermidis loves to form biofilm. Two, it can be people that are on dialysis, right? People that are on dialysis, again, they have a very high risk for like really weird, bizarre bacteremia, which can ultimately, again, lead those people to getting endocarditis. But also another new kid on the block is people that have electronic pacemakers, right? Electronic pacemakers have a very well-established association with people, unfortunately, ultimately developing infective endocarditis, right? And again, usually these people on exams, right, they will have like some kind of new heart murmur, right? And they'll have like skin petechiae, right? Now, when you're thinking about endocarditis, right, what are the different types, right? Obviously, there is going to be acute endocarditis. Many of us have also heard of like subacute endocarditis. But there's actually such a thing as chronic endocarditis, right? So what are the timelines that help you define these things? Really, it's just like how long you've had symptoms for, right? So if you've had symptoms for less than 6 weeks, for the most part, people call it acute endocarditis. If it's from 6 weeks to 3 months, people call it subacute. If it's more than 3 months, people call it chronic. But let me tell you this. If you see a person that has had symptoms over like a 2-ish week period, think more about acute endocarditis on NBME exams. But if you see a person that has gone past that 2-week period in terms of symptoms, think more in terms of subacute endocarditis. Okay, so there's the official definition of, oh, less than 6 weeks acute, 6 weeks to 3 months subacute, greater than 3 months chronic. But if you see less than 2 weeks on NBME exams, think about acute endocarditis. If you see more than 2 weeks, think more along the lines of subacute endocarditis. And obviously, if you're thinking about acute endocarditis, I mean, what's the poster child bug that causes this stuff? I hope you're telling me it's Staph aureus, right? Staph aureus is the most common cause of acute endocarditis. And one thing that's relatively unique about Staph aureus is it can actually damage a valve that is normal. In subacute endocarditis, which is something that we'll see more with strep viridans, you need to have like a pre-existing abnormal valve for you to get endocarditis on that valve, right? Again, it's a subtle point, but it's a floridly high yield point to know. If your valves are stone cold normal at baseline, in general, on NBMEs, the only kind of endocarditis you will get is acute endocarditis from Staph aureus. Staph aureus can damage a valve that is completely normal at baseline or a valve that is abnormal at baseline. But strep viridans, which is the most common cause of subacute endocarditis, torches valves that are abnormal at baseline. If your valve is normal at baseline, you have a very low risk of getting subacute endocarditis, right? Now, one other thing that you may hear a lot, again, because I feel like one of the reasons I'm also making this podcast is just to clear up some misconceptions that people have, and then they take that stuff away, and then they end up getting questions wrong on exams, right? Like, for example, you hear this, and it's thought, sadly, many med schools, oh, if your glucose is more than 400, the person has HHS. If it's less than 400, you have DKA. Folks, that's not true. In fact, the NBME actively capitalizes on this information in writing questions. As you've seen me say many times, the only thing that determines if you're in DKA or HHNS on NBM exams is not your glucose number, it's your bicarb. If your bicarb is low, doesn't matter what your glucose number is, you have DKA. If your bicarb is roughly normal, let's say if it's above like 21, okay, let me even say 20. If it's above 20 on NBM exams, doesn't matter what your glucose number is, you have HHNS. That's very important to know, right? Again, many people screw that up. So the thing I would just say is, many times you hear people, they say, oh, culture negative endocarditis, hey, sec organisms. And that was the thought before, right? But the unfortunate thing is that's still being thought very commonly in many resources, but it's wrong, right? Culture negative endocarditis, the most common cause of culture negative endocarditis is that you've gotten antibiotics before you took the blood cultures to treat the person for endocarditis, right? So the thing is, that's why many times before you start antibiotic therapy for any case of endocarditis on NBM exams, you're usually encouraged to go ahead and get a blood culture, right? Many times before you start antibiotics on endocarditis, folks, get a blood culture, right? So that you don't get into that culture negative territory, right? The most common cause, this is actually very high yield to know. The most common cause, or they can make this a risk factor question, the biggest risk factor for a negative blood cultures in a patient with endocarditis is actually the administration of antibiotics. I know it's kind of a weird question, but it's very high yield to know for exams, right? So really, like, whenever you see resources refer to culture negative endocarditis, it just means that the endocarditis that the person, like the bug causing the person's endocarditis, is a very difficult bug to grow, right? So things like, again, those HSEC organisms, I think the HSEC means, like, if I'm not mistaken, like the H stands for Haemophilus, the A stands for Actinobacillus, the C stands for Cardiobacterium, the E stands for Eikanella, and then the K stands for Kingella, if I'm not mistaken. I hope I'm remembering correctly, but I believe it's Haemophilus, Actinobacillus, Cardiobacterium, Eikanella, and Kingella, right? Those things just take time to grow. That's all, right? The culture will turn positive at some point, right? So, but if you know, everyone is not as patient, right, to wait for those things to grow. Also, Aspergillus is also something that causes, again, these things we call culture negative endocarditis. Even Coxiella is becoming, on NBMEs, a big cause of endocarditis, right? And remember, IV drug users, right, whenever they get endocarditis, what side of the heart is usually affected? It's usually going to be the left side of the heart. The right side of the heart, right? Usually going to be the right side of the heart, because think about it, IV drug user, intravenous drug user, right? So that means you literally inject the drugs into veins. Well, where do all the veins of the blood draining, of the body draining to? Well, they drain into the right side of the heart, right? So an IV drug user is like that infected blood very likely hit the tricuspid valve first, right? That's why tricuspid valve endocarditis is very common on NBM exams in people that are IV drug users, right? But in general, most cases of endocarditis is on the left side of the heart. The most common overall site of endocarditis, if you're taking all comers, is going to be the left side of the heart, right? But IV drug users, think about tricuspid valve endocarditis, right? And again, just kind of piggybacking on this, all the veins in the body draining to the right side of the heart. There's a reason why the right atrial pressure is called the central venous pressure, the CVP, because again, all the veins ultimately drain there, right? So it's like the central hub for all the veins in your body, right? That's why it's called central venous pressure, right? Because again, the MBME, if they put right atrial pressure for all these arrow questions, they know everyone will get it right, right? So they don't do that, right? So they can call right atrial pressure, central venous pressure on your test, right? So again, if you see an IV drug user, staph aureus is the likely cause of the endocarditis. And then don't forget that, again, if a person has a prosthetic heart valve, right, you want to think about staph epidermidis, especially if they got the prosthetic valve less than 2 months ago, right? That's something that's called early prosthetic valve endocarditis. If you see prosthetic valve endocarditis, you always want to think about staph epidermidis, again, especially when it's less than 60 days since they got said valve, right? So again, what are the classic symptoms you see for a person with endocarditis on MBMEs? Again, they'll have fevers. Fever is probably like the most common clinical symptom in people that have endocarditis on MBME exams, right? But you know, they'll be fatigued, right? They'll have a new heart murmur. That's always high to know, right? And then they can also have this thing called a septic emboli, right? They'll have this thing called septic emboli. Basically, these septic emboli, they are just pieces of the vegetation that break off, and then they begin to occlude things, right? So they can give you a person having gangrene, right? Especially on step one, they can give you like a gangrene question in a person that has infective endocarditis. Again, it's just that embolus or those little bits of the vegetation that have broken off, right? And they are occluding blood vessels in the legs, in the toes, right? They can even give you a stroke question. Again, septic emboli, right? Those things are basically like just thing, like parts of the vegetation breaking off and going and occluding blood vessels, right? And again, remember, these people can also have these Janeway lesions, right? You know, Janeway, right? Painless, right? It's a painless lesion on the palms and soles, right? They can have all these splinter hemorrhages. They can have these, they can even give you a question where they say that, oh, they do like angiography, right? And then they find like a wedge-shaped area of non-enhancement, right, in the wall of an organ like the spleen. Again, that's embolic phenomena, right? So basically, right, people that have endocarditis, they tend to get infarctions of the spleen especially, right? But again, remember, blood vessels branch. So whenever a person has an infarct, it's usually like in a wedge-shaped form, okay? Because the vascular territory of that central blood vessel that splits off into two, right, no longer gets blood supply, right? Sometimes they can even tell you that, oh, they perform angiography, right? And then they find like a mushroom-shaped extension or expansion of the aortic wall. If you see that, you want to think about something called a mycotic aneurysm, right? A mycotic aneurysm. Again, they know that most of these Anki decks contain the term mycotic aneurysm. You've heard me say this ad nauseum. In fact, like my Step 2 CK courses, or in general, when I'm tutoring people, I teach them like the multiple ways the MBME can say the same thing. Right, the multiple ways the MBME can say the same thing. Sometimes the MBME, they can say mycotic aneurysm. Well, glory be to God, that means your life is easy that day. But again, sometimes they can just describe it. They can just say, oh, angiography, or you know, CT angiography of the chest shows a mushroom shaped expansion of the aortic wall. If you see that, you want to think about a mycotic aneurysm, right? Again, it's just that infection that is tearing, eating away at the wall of the aorta, right? And when you eat at the wall of the aorta, that ischemia causes the aorta to begin to dilate, right? If it dilates in a mushroom shape, that's what's called a mycotic aneurysm, right? That's what's called a mycotic aneurysm. And you don't need to only get it in the aorta. You can get it pretty much in any vessel. You can even get like cerebral mycotic aneurysms, right? And then, remember, these people can also get like Osler nodes, right? So remember, those things are painful, right? Remember, Janeway lesions are painless, but Osler nodes are painful, right? And again, instead of seeing Osler nodes on the test, they can say, oh, this patient has painful nodular erythema on the hands and feet, right? They can say, oh, painful nodular erythema on the hands and feet, right? And the thing is, again, these Janeway lesions, they actually are more vascular based versus these Osler nodes that tend to be more immunologic phenomena, right? Because remember, one of the hallmarks of inflammation, right? There is tumor, dolor, rubor, color, blah, 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 right? So like pain, right? Pain is one of the hallmark things that happens when a person has inflammation, right? So actually these Osler nodes, if I'm not mistaken, one of the reasons those things are painful is because there's a lot of inflammation that creates those lesions, those painful lesions you find on the palms and soles, right? And then don't forget on the retina, they can have these rough, R-O-T-H, these rough spots, right? So again, obviously, if a person has endocarditis, what are you going to do for them? Well, you're going to do some kind of diagnostic testing, right? You're going to get a blood culture. That's always the first thing you do. Before you even give antibiotics, don't matter. You always have to get a blood culture, right? And then after you've gotten the blood culture, you can start the antibiotics. But one thing your friends at the NBME love to do is, what kind of imaging would you want to go for the heart? Remember, always go with a TEE, a transesophageal echocardiogram. Do not go with a TTE, which is a transthoracic echocardiogram, right? TEEs are better than TTEs in people that have endocarditis, right? I mean, like the TEE, the sensitivity, I believe, is almost like 90%. Versus a TTE, where the sensitivity is about 50%, right? So you're just getting a much better study, right? And again, that should make sense. One, because most cases of endocarditis involve the left side of the heart. Two, when you put an ultrasound probe in the esophagus, which is what happens in a TEE, right? You're pretty much smack dab against the left atrium. So you're going to just get much better views, right? So it would make sense that that's the right thing to do. And again, the most common cause of endocarditis, just in general, right? Again, it's going to be Staph aureus, right? The second most common cause actually is strep viridans, right? Strep viridans. And again, the thing is, your friends at the NBME, they realize that most people, oh, strep viridans. Like every Anki deck known to man, right? A Anki, B Anki, C Anki. Again, I'm not going to say anything here, right? Anki is a great resource. But I feel like my only quip with Anki is, I feel like many people, they memorize stuff mindlessly, but then they have like zero understanding of what they are memorizing. And then they notice that, man, I've done this Anki deck, I've matured this Anki deck, and somehow I'm not getting 270s on my practice exams. It's because the understanding is not there. Again, the NBME, they are not novices. They are aware of what exists out there. They know that there are people that, oh, memorize, right? So again, I'm not saying you shouldn't memorize. You need to memorize to do well on the USMLEs. But that's just one of the steps. You also need to understand what in the world you are memorizing. I'm telling you, I can literally, because I love writing questions, I can literally write a bunch of questions where memorization won't do you diddly squat. You actually need to understand what's going on to get those answers correct. So again, I encourage people to use Anki. Anki is great. It is phenomenal. It's fantastic. It's probably one of the best inventions in medical education. But make sure that you're understanding what you're committing to memory. If you can do that, then your use of Anki is a lot more prudent in those circumstances, right? So again, Staph aureus is the most common cause. Second most common cause of endocarditis is strep viridans. But again, strep viridans, you need to know the alternate names, right? There are many things that can be strep viridans on your test, right? You can have like strep oralis, O-R-A-L-I-S, strep mitis, M-I-T-S, strep sanguis, S-A-N-G-U-I-S, right? So I remember that with the mnemonic school of medicine, S-O-M, the S for sanguis, the O for oralis, and the M for mitis, okay? That's the way to keep that straight on exams, right? And the third most common cause of endocarditis actually is these enterococcal species, right? Enterococcal species. But again, if you see an IV drug user, think about Staph aureus, right? And people can get these things from, again, they can get like, especially like this viridans endocarditis, they can get it from like a tooth extraction of some sort, right? Or you can even get it as an IV drug user if you lick your needles, if you mix it with saliva, right? Because your saliva very likely contains strep viridans, right? Or if you go for like a procedure where they manipulate your GU tract, your genital urinary tract, or your GI tract, again, those things in general tend to have this nice association with enterococcal endocarditis, right? So if you see a GI procedure or a GU procedure on NBME exams and the person has endocarditis afterwards, I want you to think about enterococcus, right? Or they can give you a question about a person that has endocarditis from a foot puncture, right? So they were punctured by a nail in their feet. If you see that, you want to think about Pseudomonas as the cause of the endocarditis, right? Or you see a person that has endocarditis and they have colon cancers, right? There are some bugs you want to think about. You want to think about strep bovis. Strep bovis is a common one on exams. But another common one on exams, a new kid on the block, is something called Clostridium septicum, right? Clostridium septicum. You're hearing me repeat it over and over again. I'm not repeating it for funsies, okay? It's very high yield to no Clostridium septicum. And I know many people may say, like, Divine, why is it that these bugs have an association with, like, where, oh, let's say a person has endocarditis, you do blood culture, you grow strep bovis, or you grow Clostridium septicum. Why would these things be associated with colon cancer? The thing is, the thought, at least from my research, is that many people believe that people that have colon cancers, those colon cancers can kind of break down the barrier. Because the thing is, there is like a pretty decent amount of mucosal layers or whatever that exists between the lumen of the colon and the blood vessels that drain the bowel and send the blood back to the liver. So the thing is, whenever a person has an invasive malignancy, especially an invasive colon cancer, that invasive colon cancer can pretty much take over the walls, these mucosal surfaces, right? And they can basically like leach the mucosal surface all the way to the blood vessel, right? And then get into the blood vessel, right? So bugs that you normally find in the lumen of the colon, like strep bovis or Clostridium septicum, can translocate through, get into the bloodstream, and then go and deposit on heart valves, right? That's why, again, if a person has endocarditis and you grow strep bovis or Clostridium septicum, then you're worried about those people potentially having colon cancer, okay? So that's the mechanism there, right? And again, if you see endocarditis in a person that's super immunocompromised, think about Candida albicans, right? Remember, just like Staph epidermidis, Candida actually is also able to form biofilm, right? So that's one of the reasons why it's a very nice risk factor for endocarditis in people that have prosthetic valves or whatever. But again, the first thing you should think about for prosthetic valve endocarditis is going to be Staph epidermidis. It is the most common cause of prosthetic valve endocarditis on NBM exams. But if you don't see that as an answer, I'll encourage you to also consider Candida albicans, especially in a person that is super immunocompromised, like a person that's on immunosuppression because they got a transplant or something of that nature. Right? And then one other thing that you want to think about, right, is, wow, Divine, why is it that people that have some of these heart defects tend to get endocarditis, right? So let's say like for having a VSD, for example. The thing is, when a person has like a VSD or a PDA, right, or an ASD or whatever, those heart problems tend to cause turbulent blood flow, right? So like a VSD, for example, people can have turbulent blood flow. The thing is, whenever you have turbulent blood flow, that increases the risk of deposition of organisms. Because the thing is, when blood moves a certain way, it actually makes it much harder for bacteria to kind of like settle on surfaces. Those bacteria usually get just pushed along. They keep moving forward. They keep it moving. But if a person has a lot of turbulent flow, that can prevent bacteria from keeping it moving in the appropriate way. They can begin to hang out on things, right? Like a VSD, right? Like, oh, around a VSD, a ton of turbulent flow. Those things are all risk factors for endocarditis, right? So the thing is, in general, for endocarditis, right, how do you prophylax, right? Like, again, remember, if you're getting like a GI procedure or a GU procedure or, you know, like an invasive respiratory procedure or a dental procedure, in general, right, the people you want to prophylax are people that have, you know, like maybe had endocarditis in the past, so they have a prior history of endocarditis, or it can be a person that has like an unrepaired cyanotic congenital heart defect, right? Or people that have prosthetic valves. And usually you just give these people like amoxicillin or ampicillin. Just give them some kind of penicillin-based product like amoxicillin. Remember, amoxicillin is oral. Or you can give ampicillin or whatever, right? Like, which is more IV. Remember, ampicillin has a ton of I's in it, right? So it's IV. Amoxicillin has an O in it, so it's oral, right? So that's a nice way to kind of keep those straight. And for the most part, you just give those like an hour before the procedure starts, and those patients should be good to go for the most part, right? But again, if you want to empirically treat while you're waiting for blood culture results, so remember, the drugs I talked about are for prophylaxis, but for actual treatment, you give the combination of ceftriaxone and vancomycin, right? You give the combination of ceftriaxone and vancomycin, ceftriaxone and vancomycin. So I think maybe let me go ahead and pause here, because let me just focus on this endocarditis business. The thing I would just say is, you know what, let me talk about myocarditis real quick. Again, many of us know myocarditis on exams, right? For the most part, the big thing is it'll be a person that had an upper respiratory infection. And then a few days or weeks later, and they'll tell you that, oh, the URI resolved without treatment or whatever fancy story they give. And then they'll tell you that, oh, this person, you know, has been having like heart failure symptoms, right? So they'll have like orthopnea, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. They'll have like edema in the lower extremities. They'll have crackles in the lungs. And usually on NBMEs, they'll tell you that they have a new S3 heart sound. That's very high yield to know. They have a new S3 heart sound. If you see that, you want to think about myocarditis, right? Now, what is the most common cause of myocarditis? Well, that's easy. It's usually a viral infection, right? Especially like Coxsackie B. So please do not conflate or I guess confuse Coxsackie B with Coxsackie A on NBME exams. Coxsackie A causes hepangina, right? That thing that many of us affectionately call hand, foot, mouth disease, right? They can have, remember Coxsackie A, right? It's one of those things that cause lesions on the palms and soles, right? Remember the mnemonic, you drive Kawasaki cars with your hands and feet, right? So Kawasaki's disease, Coxsackie A, rickettsia, rickettsii, and syphilis, right? Secondary syphilis. Those all cause lesions on the palms and on the soles, right? So the thing is, Coxsackie A causes hand, foot, mouth disease, but Coxsackie B is the thing that causes viral myocarditis, right? Viral myocarditis. And the treatment of myocarditis, right? You basically treat it like you treat heart failure, right? You give like an ACE inhibitor, you give a beta blocker, you give a diuretic, right? Just remember your ABD. We're pretty much keeping a C, right? So an ACE inhibitor, a beta blocker, diuretic, those are all things you give for myocarditis, right? You treat them like heart failure, right? And again, you'll have a recent upper respiratory infection. And sometimes the NBME can try to trick you on exams, right? They will give you like the troponins elevated. But again, if you see the temporal association with recent upper respiratory infection, you see heart failure symptoms, don't think of an MI. Again, it's not everyone that has an elevated troponin that has an MI, right? And the thing is, myocarditis, the timeline, right, is more like days/weeks of symptoms, not hours or minutes of symptoms. That's one thing that will help you differentiate between an MI and myocarditis on exams, right? So again, remember MI, sudden onset, severe chest pain, relating to the jaw, to the arm or something like that, right? Versus a person that has myocarditis, where again, it will be like at least a few days of heart failure style symptoms. They'll have the new S3 heart sound, okay? They'll have the new S3 heart sound. So that's, again, very, very high yield to know for exams, right? Very high yield to know for exams. Their CRP will be elevated. Their ESR will be elevated. Because, again, they have this chronic inflammatory state. And usually on NBMEs, when they give you an EKG for a person that has myocarditis, they'll have inverted T waves, right? They'll have inverted T waves. They'll have inverted T waves. Now, what is the most common cause of endocarditis? I mean, why do I keep saying this? So remember I said the most common cause of myocarditis in the US is Coxsackie B, right? The most common cause of myocarditis all over the world, right? All over the world is actually Trypanosoma cruzii. Remember, Trypanosoma cruzii loves to cause big things, right? Again, it can cause it can cause dilated cardiomyopathy, right? It can cause dilated cardiomyopathy. Let's leave it at that. It causes a big heart, right? And then it can also cause, so it's not wet beriberi. Wet beriberi is more for an alcoholic. It can also cause a big esophagus, right? It can cause a achalasia. And then it can also cause a big GI tract, right? It can cause a Hirschsprung's disease, right? It can cause like a megacolon, essentially, right? Because it can pretty much consume your nerve plexi that's in the distal colon, right? And again, it's not just bugs that cause myocarditis, right? You can also get it from certain drugs. And one thing I will just establish, whenever a person has myocarditis on NBME exams, always think of those people as having a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So just in your mind, mentally translate myocarditis to dilated cardiomyopathy on tests, right? And again, remember that the drugs that can cause these myocarditis, right, will be things like clozapine, right? So you can give an antipsychotic question with that. Another one could be alcohol, right? I mean, the more alcohol you take, right? Alcohol impairs gluconeogenesis. It impairs ATP production. So if ATP is not being produced adequately, right, then the thing that's going to happen is your heart, because think about it, right, like why do people get into problems with an MI, right? It occludes blood flow, so blood is not flowing to certain regions of the heart. So nutrients and energy are not flowing to those regions of the heart, right? And then the heart doesn't function well. kind of like the same thing here, right? Alcohol impairs ATP production. So even if blood flow is normal in your coronary vessels, that blood is not rich in ATP, right? That can begin to cause the heart to become ischemic, right? So those are two big things to keep in mind. But other drugs, remember your anthracyclines, right? So things like Doxo and donorubicin, right? Those things can also cause myocarditis, right? Again, they cause inflammation by virtue of the Fentin reaction because they are very powerful iron chelators, right? So they can cause a lot of free radical damage to a person's heart. That's why when you're taking those drugs, you need to take dexrazoxane, right? I'll say that again, dexrazoxane, D-E-X-R-A-Z-O-X-A-N-E, right? So dexrazoxane. Dexrazoxane is an iron chelator that you can use to prevent the myocarditis or, you know, the dilated cardiomyopathy that comes with these anthracyclines. And remember, doxodonorubicin, whenever they cause dilated cardiomyopathy, it's irreversible, right? Contrast this with trastuzumab. Trastuzumab is a monoclonal antibody against HER2, right? It's used as treatment for people that have breast cancer, right? So the thing with trastuzumab is it can also cause dilated cardiomyopathy, right? But it's reversible. So many times on NBM exams, they can ask you a question and say, oh, prior to initiating like an anthracycline or trastuzumab, what is your next best step in management? I would hope you're picking the answer that involves to get some kind of echocardiogram to estimate the ejection fraction, right? Just to monitor them throughout disease and follow their treatment course. So hopefully that makes sense, right? Now, the last things I'll just share is, how do you diagnose myocarditis? Well, that's actually pretty easy. You pretty much perform like some kind of coronary, like you take them to the cath lab, and usually you perform something called an endomyocardial biopsy, right? So you take a biopsy of the endocardium and the myocardium, right? So you do an endomyocardial biopsy, right, to make the diagnosis. And usually when you take a specimen and you look at it under the microscope, right, they may ask you, oh, remember again, the NBME, they do all these things that I call pathophysiological answers, where they'll give you a bunch of answers and it will be descriptions of pathophysiological processes. So remember, histologically, for people that have myocarditis, you would see like a lot of macrophages, a lot of lymphocytes, and then you see a lot of edema between the cardiac myocytes, right? Because of that, again, that fluid buildup. Right. So again, don't forget interstitial edema with tons and tons and tons of macrophages and lymphocytes. Those are the things you find histologically in people that have myocarditis. So I guess I'll go ahead and actually wrap up now. Right. So as I do, again, remember, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USML exams, step one to step three, and also preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. I, you know, tutor for if you're a medicine resident and you're preparing for your boards, like your ABIM board exam or the entry exam, I do tutor for those. And then again, I have step one and step two CK courses. My step one course is from the 5th to the 9th of April. My step two CK courses, I have the MME test taking strategies course. That's on the 24th of this month. Right. Again, we'll have a ton of questions. Learn how to take NBME exams in a standardized fashion. And again, I'll teach you a lot of tips and tricks so that you can very confidently, even if it's questions where you're like, I have no idea what's going on here, you can still get them right. And then again, I have the 16 and a half hour course from the 25th to the 27th of this month. Again, it's for step two CK and for step three. And then next month, from the 5th to the 9th of April, you know, I have the step one course. And then finally, please subscribe to the website, again, divineinterventionpodcast.com. I have these podcasts also on Google Podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, and on Spotify. So please subscribe. I even have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So again, any subscription helps, any feedback or whatever definitely helps. So I want to share a life lesson today. And my life lesson is going to be on the importance of arriving on time, right? This is sadly a big, big, big problem. And again, I'm even almost calling myself out, although I try to be pretty early to most things, right? But I would just say that it's very important as individuals. It's just a behavioral thing, and it's something that you can easily change, is to just show up on time. Be the kind of person that shows up 5 minutes before time consistently, right? Because when you do that, you kind of show people that you care about them. And you kind of show people that you respect them, right? You care about them and you respect them. Because the thing is, many people are They're always late, always late, always late. And the thing is, this tends to bite people in the ass in residency. When people know that you are the latecomer, 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 sometimes you can get written up as a result of it. And there are some good opportunities that you miss out on when you just show up late, right? I mean, even the Bible says, the Bible talks about timing. It says there is a time to reap and a time to sow. There is a time to give birth, a time to die, a time to this, a time to that, a time to this, a time to that, right? So even God like pays attention to timing, right? So, you know, you should probably pay attention to timing as well in your daily life. So just show up for things on time. It's always helpful. And again, your seniors will love you, right? Your seniors will love you when you show up on time. So just something to keep in mind. My next life lesson will hopefully maybe come in the next podcast. So thank you for listening today. Again, I'll encourage you to know this podcast pretty cold. It'll be very unusual for you to take a step one, step two CQ, or step three exam and not see some concepts that were covered pretty much today. So thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Bye.